Chapter 5. West of Eden. Compared with the theocratic terrors of medieval Europe, or those that persist in much of the Muslim world, the influence of religion in the West now seems rather benign. We should not be misled by such comparisons, however. The degree to which religious ideas still determine government policies, especially those of the United States, presents a grave danger to everyone. It has been widely reported, for instance, that Ronald Reagan perceived the paroxysms in the Middle East through the lens of biblical prophecy. He went so far as to include men like Jerry Falwell and Hal Lindsey in his national security briefings. It should go without saying that theirs are not the sober minds one wants consulted about the deployment of nuclear weaponry. For many years, U.S. policy in the Middle East has been shaped, at least in part, by the interests that fundamentalist Christians have in the future of a Jewish state. Christian support for Israel is, in fact, an example of religious cynicism so transcendental as to go almost unnoticed in our political discourse. Fundamentalist Christians support Israel because they believe that the final consolidation of Jewish power in the Holy Land, specifically the rebuilding of Solomon's Temple, will usher in both the second coming of Christ and the final destruction of the Jews. Such smiling anticipations of genocide seem to have presided over the Jewish state from its first moments. The first international support for the Jewish return to Palestine, Britain's Balfour Declaration of 1917, was inspired, at least in part, by a conscious conformity to biblical prophecy. These intrusions of eschatology into modern politics suggest that the dangers of religious faith can scarcely be overstated. Millions of Christians and Muslims now organize their lives around prophetic traditions that will only find fulfillment once rivers of blood begin flowing from Jerusalem. It is not at all difficult to imagine how prophecies of internecine war, once taken seriously, could become self-fulfilling. The Eternal Legislator. Many members of the U.S. government currently view their professional responsibilities in religious terms. Consider the case of Roy Moore, Chief Justice of the Alabama Supreme Court. Finding himself confronted by the sixth highest murder rate in the nation, Justice Moore thought it expedient to install a 2.5-ton monument of the Ten Commandments in the rotunda of the state courthouse in Montgomery. Almost no one disputes that this was a violation of the spirit, if not the letter, of the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. When a federal court ordered Justice Moore to remove the monument, he refused. Not wanting to have an obvious hand in actually separating church and state, the U.S. Congress amended an appropriations bill to ensure that federal funds could not be used for the monument's removal. Attorney General John Ashcroft, whose sole business is to enforce the nation's laws, maintained a pious silence all the while. This was not surprising, given that when he does speak, he is in the habit of saying things like, "We are a nation called to defend freedom, freedom that is not the grant of any government or document, but is our endowment from God." According to a Gallup poll, Ashcroft and the Congress were on firm ground as far as the American people were concerned, because 78% of those polled objected to the removal of the monument. One wonders whether Moore, Ashcroft, the U.S. Congress, and 3/4 of the American people would like to see the punishments for breaking these hallowed commandments also specified in marble and placed in our nation's courts. What, after all, is the punishment for taking the Lord's name in vain? It happens to be death. Leviticus chapter 24, verse 16. What is the punishment for working on the Sabbath? Also death. Exodus chapter 31, verse 15. What is the punishment for cursing one's father or mother? Death again. Exodus chapter 21, verse 17. What is the punishment for adultery? You're catching on. Leviticus chapter 20, verse 10. While the commandments themselves are difficult to remember, especially since chapters 20 and 34 of Exodus provide us with incompatible lists, the penalty for breaking them is simplicity itself. Contemporary examples of governmental piety are everywhere to be seen. Many prominent Republicans belong to the Council for National Policy, a secretive Christian pressure group founded by the fundamentalist Tim LaHaye, co-author of the apocalyptic Left Behind series of novels. This organization meets quarterly to discuss who knows what. George W. Bush gave a closed-door speech to the council in 1999, after which the Christian right endorsed his candidacy. Indeed, 40% of those who eventually voted for Bush were white evangelicals. Beginning with his appointment of John Ashcroft as his attorney general, President Bush found no lack of occasions on which to return the favor. The Departments of Justice, Housing and Urban Development, Health and Human Services, and Education now regularly issue directives that blur the separation between church and state. In his faith-based initiative, Bush has managed to funnel tens of millions of taxpayer dollars directly to church groups to be used more or less however they see fit. One of his appointments to the Food and Drug Administration was Dr. W. David Hager, a pro-life obstetrician who has declared publicly that premarital sex is a sin and that any attempt to separate Christian truth and secular truth is dangerous. Lieutenant General William G. Boykin was recently appointed Deputy Undersecretary of Defense for Intelligence at the Pentagon. A highly decorated Special Forces officer, he now sets policy with respect to the search for Osama bin Laden, Mullah Omar, and the rest of America's enemies in hiding. He is also, it turns out, an ardent opponent of Satan. Analyzing a photograph of Mogadishu after the fateful routing of his forces there in 1993, Boykin remarked that certain shadows in the image revealed the principalities of darkness, a demonic presence in that city that God revealed to me as the enemy. On the subject of the war on terror, he has asserted that our enemy is a guy named Satan. While these remarks sparked some controversy in the media, most Americans probably took them in stride. After all, 65% of us are quite certain that Satan exists. Men eager to do the Lord's work have been elected to other branches of the federal government as well. The House Majority Leader, Tom DeLay, is given to profundities like, "Only Christianity offers a way to live in response to the realities that we find in this world. Only Christianity." He claims to have gone into politics to promote a biblical worldview. Apparently feeling that it is impossible to say anything stupid while in the service of this worldview, he attributed the shootings at the Columbine High School in Colorado to the fact that our schools teach the theory of evolution. We might wonder how it is that pronouncements this floridly irrational do not lead to immediate censure and removal from office. Facts of this sort can be catalogued without apparent end, to the vexation of reader and writer alike. I will cite just one more, now from the judicial branch. In January of 2002, Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia, a devout Catholic, delivered a speech at the University of Chicago Divinity School on the subject of the death penalty. I quote Scalia at some length because his remarks reveal just how close we are to living in a theocracy. "This is not the Old Testament," I emphasize, "but St. Paul. The core of his message is that government, however you want to limit that concept, derives its moral authority from God. Indeed, it seems to me that the more Christian a country is, the less likely it is to regard the death penalty as immoral. I attribute that to the fact that, for the believing Christian, death is no big deal. Intentionally killing an innocent person is a big deal. It is a grave sin which causes one to lose his soul. But losing this life in exchange for the next? For the non-believer, on the other hand, to deprive a man of his life is to end his existence, What a horrible act! The reaction of people of faith to this tendency of democracy to obscure the divine authority behind government should not be resignation to it, but the resolution to combat it as effectively as possible. We have done that in this country, and continental Europe has not, by preserving in our public life many visible reminders that, in the words of a Supreme Court opinion from the 1940s, we are a religious people whose institutions presuppose a supreme being. All this, as I say, is most un-European, and helps explain why our people are more inclined to understand, as St. Paul did, that government carries the sword as the minister of God to execute wrath upon the evildoer. All of this should be terrifying to anyone who expects that reason will prevail in the inner sanctums of power in the West. Scalia is right to observe that what a person believes happens after death determines his view of it, and therefore his ethics. Although he is a Catholic, Scalia differs from the Pope on the subject of capital punishment, but then so do a majority of Americans, 74%. It is remarkable that we are the last civilized nation to put evildoers to death, and Justice Scalia rightly attributes this to our style of religiosity. Perhaps we can take a moment in this context to wonder whether our unique position in the world is really the moral accomplishment that Scalia imagines it to be. We know, for instance, that no human being creates his own genes or his early life experiences, and yet most of us believe that these factors determine his character throughout life. It seems true enough to say that the men and women on death row either have bad genes, bad parents, bad ideas, or bad luck. Which of these quantities are they responsible for? Resorting to biblical justifications for capital punishment does nothing to reconcile our growing understanding of human behavior with our desire for retribution in the face of the most appalling crimes. There is undoubtedly an important secular debate to be had about the ethics of the death penalty, but it is just as obvious that we should be drawing upon sources that show a greater understanding of the human mind and modern society than is evident in St. Paul. But men like Scalia, men who believe that we already have God's eternal decrees on paper, have been inoculated against doubts on this subject, or indeed against the nuances of a scientific worldview. It is not surprising that Scalia is the kind of judge that President Bush has sought to appoint to the federal courts. Scalia supports the use of capital punishment, even in cases where the defendant is acknowledged to be mentally retarded. He also upholds state sodomy laws, in this case, even when they are applied in an exclusive and discriminating way to homosexuals. Needless to say, Scalia has found legal reasons to insist that the Supreme Court not leaven the religious dogmatism of the states. But he leaves little doubt that he looks to St. Paul, and perhaps to the barbarous author of Leviticus, for guidance on these matters. The War on Sin. In the United States, and in much of the rest of the world, it is currently illegal to seek certain experiences of pleasure. Seek pleasure by a forbidden means, even in the privacy of your own home, and men with guns may kick in the door and carry you away to prison for it. One of the most surprising things about this situation is how unsurprising most of us find it. As in most dreams, the very faculty of reason that would otherwise notice the strangeness of these events seems to have succumbed to sleep. Behaviors like drug use, prostitution, sodomy, and the viewing of obscene materials have been categorized as victimless crimes. Of course, society is the tangible victim of almost everything human beings do, from making noise to manufacturing chemical waste. But we have not made it a crime to do such things within certain limits. Setting these limits is invariably a matter of assessing risk. One could argue that it is, at the very least, conceivable that certain activities engaged in private, like the viewing of sexually violent pornography, might incline some people to commit genuine crimes against others. There is a tension, therefore, between private freedom and public risk. If there were a drug, or a book, or a film, or a sexual position that led 90% of its users to rush into the street and begin killing people at random, concerns over private pleasure would surely yield to those of public safety. We can also stipulate that no one is eager to see generations of children raised on a steady diet of methamphetamine and Marquis de Sade. Society as a whole has an interest in how its children develop, and the private behavior of parents, along with the contents of our media, clearly play a role in this. But we must ask ourselves, why would anyone want to punish people for engaging in behavior that brings no significant risk of harm to anyone? Indeed, what is startling about the notion of a victimless crime is that even when the behavior in question is genuinely victimless, its criminality is still affirmed by those who are eager to punish it. It is in such cases that the true genius lurking behind many of our laws stands revealed. The idea of a victimless crime is nothing more than a judicial reprise of the Christian notion of sin. It is no accident that people of faith often want to curtail the private freedoms of others. This impulse has less to do with the history of religion and more to do with its logic, because the very idea of privacy is incompatible with the existence of God. If God sees and knows all things, and remains so provincial a creature as to be scandalized by certain sexual behaviors or states of the brain, then what people do in the privacy of their own homes, though it may not have the slightest implication for their behavior in public, will still be a matter of public concern for people of faith. A variety of religious notions of wrongdoing can be seen converging here. Concerns over non-procreative sexuality and idolatry, especially. And these seem to have given many of us the sense that it is ethical to punish people, often severely, for engaging in private behavior that harms no one. Like most costly examples of irrationality in which human happiness has been blindly subverted for generations, the role of religion here is both explicit and foundational. To see that our laws against vice have actually nothing to do with keeping people from coming to physical or psychological harm, and everything to do with not angering God, we need only consider that oral or anal sex between consenting adults remains a criminal offense in 13 states. 4 of the states, Texas, Kansas, Oklahoma, and Missouri, prohibit these acts between same-sex couples and, therefore, effectively prohibit homosexuality. The other 9 ban consensual sodomy for everyone. These places of equity are Alabama, Florida, Idaho, Louisiana, Mississippi, North Carolina, South Carolina, Utah, and Virginia. One does not have to be a demographer to grasp at the impulse to prosecute consenting adults for non-procreative sexual behavior will correlate rather strongly with religious faith. The influence of faith on our criminal laws comes at a remarkable price. Consider the case of drugs. As it happens, there are many substances, many of them naturally occurring, the consumption of which leads to transient states of inordinate pleasure. Occasionally, it is true, they lead to transient states of misery as well, but there is no doubt that pleasure is the norm. Otherwise, human beings would not have felt the continual desire to take such substances for millennia. Of course, pleasure is precisely the problem with these substances, since pleasure and piety have always had an uneasy relationship. When one looks at our drug laws, indeed, at our vice laws altogether, the only organizing principle that appears to make sense of them is that anything which might radically eclipse prayer or procreative sexuality as a source of pleasure has been outlawed. In particular, any drug, LSD, mescaline, psilocybin, DMT, MDMA, marijuana, etc., to which spiritual or religious significance has been ascribed by its users, has been prohibited. Concerns about the health of our citizens or about their productivity are red herrings in this debate, as the legality of alcohol and cigarettes attests. The fact that people are being prosecuted and imprisoned for using marijuana, while alcohol remains a staple commodity, is surely the reductio ad absurdum of any notion that our drug laws are designed to keep people from harming themselves or others. Alcohol is, by any measure, the more dangerous substance. It has no approved medical use, and its lethal dose is rather easily achieved. Its role in causing automobile accidents is beyond dispute. The manner in which alcohol relieves people of their inhibitions contributes to human violence, personal injury, unplanned pregnancy, and the spread of sexual disease. Alcohol is also well known to be addictive. When consumed in large quantities over many years, it can lead to devastating neurological impairments, to cirrhosis of the liver, and to death. In the United States alone, more than 100,000 people annually die from its use. It is also more toxic to a developing fetus than any other drug of abuse. Indeed, crack babies appear to have been really suffering from fetal alcohol syndrome. None of these charges can be leveled at marijuana. As a drug, marijuana is nearly unique in having several medical applications and no known lethal dosage. While adverse reactions to drugs like aspirin and ibuprofen account for an estimated 7,600 deaths and 76,000 hospitalizations each year in the United States alone, marijuana kills no one. Its role as a gateway drug now seems less plausible than ever, and it was never plausible. In fact, nearly everything human beings do, driving cars, flying planes, hitting golf balls, is more dangerous than smoking marijuana in the privacy of one's own home. Anyone who would seriously attempt to argue that marijuana is worthy of prohibition because of the risk it poses to human beings will find that the powers of the human brain are simply insufficient for the job. And yet, we are so far from the shady groves of reason now that people are still receiving life sentences without the possibility of parole for growing, selling, possessing, or buying what is, in fact, a naturally occurring plant. Cancer patients and paraplegics have been sentenced to decades in prison for marijuana possession. Owners of garden supply stores have received similar sentences because some of their customers were caught growing marijuana. What explains this astonishing wastage of human life and material resources? The only explanation is that our discourse on this subject has never been obliged to function within the bounds of rationality. Under our current laws, it is safe to say, if a drug were invented that posed no risk of physical harm or addiction to its users, but produced a brief feeling of spiritual bliss and epiphany in 100% of those who tried it, this drug would be illegal, and people would be punished mercilessly for its use. Only anxiety about the biblical crime of idolatry would appear to make sense of this retributive impulse. Because we are a people of faith, taught to concern ourselves with the sinfulness of our neighbors, we have grown tolerant of irrational uses of state power. Our prohibition of certain substances has led thousands of otherwise productive and law-abiding men and women to be locked away for decades at a stretch, sometimes for life. Their children have become wards of the state. As if such cascading horror were not disturbing enough, violent criminals, murderers, rapists, and child molesters, are regularly paroled to make room for them. Here we appear to have overstepped the banality of evil and plunge to the absurdity at its depths. The consequences of our irrationality on this front are so egregious that they bear closer examination. Each year, over 1.5 million men and women are arrested in the United States because of our drug laws. At this moment, somewhere on the order of 400,000 men and women languish in U.S. prisons for nonviolent drug offenses. 1 million others are currently on probation. More people are imprisoned for nonviolent drug offenses in the United States than are incarcerated for any reason in all of Western Europe, which has a larger population. The cost of these efforts, at the federal level alone, is nearly $20 billion annually. The total cost of our drug laws, when one factors in the expense to state and local governments and the tax revenue lost by our failure to regulate the sale of drugs, could easily be in excess of $100 billion each year. Our war on drugs consumes an estimated 50% of the trial time of our courts and the full-time energies of over 400,000 police officers. These are resources that might otherwise be used to fight violent crime and terrorism. In historical terms, there was every reason to expect that such a policy of prohibition would fail. It is well known, for instance, that the experiment with the prohibition of alcohol in the United States did little more than precipitate a terrible comedy of increased drinking, organized crime, and police corruption. What is not generally remembered is that prohibition was an explicitly religious exercise, being the joint product of the Women's Christian Temperance Union and the pious lobbying of certain Protestant missionary societies. The problem with the prohibition of any desirable commodity is money. The United Nations values the drug trade at $400 billion a year. This exceeds the annual budget for the U.S. Department of Defense. If this figure is correct, the trade in illegal drugs constitutes 8% of all international commerce, while the sale of textiles makes up 7.5%, and motor vehicles just 5.3%. And yet, prohibition itself is what makes the manufacture and sale of drugs so extraordinarily profitable. Those who earn their living in this way enjoy a 5,000 to 20,000% return on their investment, tax-free. Every relevant indicator of the drug trade, rates of drug use and interdiction, estimates of production, the purity of drugs on the street, etc., shows that the government can do nothing to stop it as long as such profits exist. Indeed, these profits are highly corrupting of law enforcement, in any case. The crimes of the addict to finance the stratospheric cost of his lifestyle, and the crimes of the dealer to protect both his territory and his goods, are likewise the results of prohibition. A final irony, which seems good enough to be the work of Satan himself, is that the market we have created by our drug laws has become a steady source of revenue for terrorist organizations like Al-Qaeda, Islamic Jihad, Hezbollah, Shining Path, and others. Even if we acknowledge that stopping drug use is a justifiable social goal, how does the financial cost of our war on drugs appear in light of the other challenges we face? Consider that it would require only a one-time expenditure of $2 billion to secure our commercial seaports against smuggled nuclear weapons. At present, we have allocated a mere $93 million for this purpose. How will our prohibition of marijuana use look? This comes at a cost of $4 billion annually. If a new sun ever dawns over the port of Los Angeles. Or consider that the U.S. government can afford to spend only $2.3 billion each year on the reconstruction of Afghanistan. The Taliban and Al-Qaeda are now regrouping. Warlords rule the countryside, beyond the city limits of Kabul. Which is more important to us, reclaiming this part of the world for the forces of civilization, or keeping cancer patients in Berkeley from relieving their nausea with marijuana? Our present use of government funds suggests an uncanny skewing, we might even say derangement, of our national priorities. Such a bizarre allocation of resources is sure to keep Afghanistan in ruins for many years to come. It will also leave Afghan farmers with no alternative but to grow opium. Happily for them, our drug laws still render this a highly profitable enterprise. Anyone who believes that God is watching us from beyond the stars will feel that punishing peaceful men and women for their private pleasure is perfectly reasonable. We are now in the 21st century. Perhaps we should have better reasons for depriving our neighbors of their liberty at gunpoint. Given the magnitude of the real problems that confront us, terrorism, nuclear proliferation, the spread of infectious disease, failing infrastructure, lack of adequate funds for education and health care, etc., our war on sin is so outrageously unwise as to almost defy rational comment. How have we grown so blind to our deeper interests? And how have we managed to enact such policies with so little substantive debate? The God of Medicine. While there is surely an opposition between reason and faith, we will see that there is none between reason and love, or reason and spirituality. The basis for this claim is simple. Every experience that a human being can have admits of rational discussion about its causes and consequences, or about our ignorance thereof. Although this leaves considerable room for the exotic, it leaves none at all for faith. There may yet be good reasons to believe in psychic phenomena, alien life, the doctrine of rebirth, the healing power of prayer, or anything else, but our credulity must scale with the evidence. The doctrine of faith denies this. From the perspective of faith, it is better to ape the behavior of one's ancestors than to find creative ways to uncover new truths in the present. There are sources of irrationality other than religious faith, of course, but none of them are celebrated for their role in shaping public policy. Supreme Court justices are not in the habit of praising our nation for its reliance upon astrology, or for its wealth of UFO sightings, or for exemplifying the various reasoning biases that psychologists have found to be more or less endemic to our species. Only mainstream religious dogmatism receives the unqualified support of government. And yet, religious faith obscures uncertainty where uncertainty manifestly exists, allowing the unknown, the implausible, and the patently false to achieve primacy over the facts. Consider the present debate over research on human embryonic stem cells. The problem with this research, from the religious point of view, is simple. It entails the destruction of human embryos. The embryos in question will have been cultured in vitro, not removed from a woman's body, and permitted to grow for 3 to 5 days. At this stage of development, an embryo is called a blastocyst and consists of about 150 cells arranged in a microscopic sphere. Interior to the blastocyst is a small group of about 30 embryonic stem cells. These cells have two properties that make them of such abiding interest to scientists. As stem cells, they can remain in an unspecialized state, reproducing themselves through cell division for long periods of time. A population of such cells living in culture is known as a cell line. Stem cells are also pluripotent, which means they have the potential to become any specialized cell in the human body. Neurons of the brain and spinal cord, insulin-producing cells of the pancreas, muscle cells of the heart, and so forth. Here is what we know. We know that much can be learned from research on embryonic stem cells. In particular, such research may give us further insight into the processes of cell division and cell differentiation. This would almost certainly shed new light on those medical conditions, like cancer and birth defects, that seem to be merely a matter of these processes gone awry. We also know that research on embryonic stem cells requires the destruction of human embryos at the 150-cell stage. There is not the slightest reason to believe, however, that such embryos have the capacity to sense pain, to suffer, or to experience the loss of life in any way at all. What is indisputable is that there are millions of human beings who do have these capacities and who currently suffer from traumatic injuries to the brain and spinal cord. Millions more suffer from Parkinson's and Alzheimer's diseases. Millions more suffer from stroke and heart disease, from burns, from diabetes, from rheumatoid arthritis, from Purkinje cell degeneration, from Duchenne muscular dystrophy, and from vision and hearing loss. We know that embryonic stem cells promise to be a renewable source of tissues and organs that might alleviate such suffering in the not-too-distant future. Enter faith. We now find ourselves living in a world in which college-educated politicians will hurl impediments in the way of such research because they are concerned about the fate of single cells. Their concern is not merely that a collection of 150 cells may suffer its destruction. Rather, they believe that even a human zygote, a fertilized egg, should be accorded all the protections of a fully developed human being. Such a cell, after all, has the potential to become a fully developed human being. But given our recent advances in the biology of cloning, as much can be said of almost every cell in the human body. By the measure of a cell's potential, whenever the president scratches his nose, he is now engaged in a diabolical culling of souls. Out of deference to some rather poorly specified tenets of Christian doctrine, after all, nothing in the Bible suggests that killing human embryos, or even human fetuses, is the equivalent of killing a human being, the U.S. House of Representatives voted effectively to ban embryonic stem cell research on February 27, 2003. No rational approach to ethics would have led us to such an impasse. Our present policy on human stem cells has been shaped by beliefs that are divorced from every reasonable intuition we might form about the possible experience of living systems. In neurological terms, we surely visit more suffering upon this earth by killing a fly than by killing a human blastocyst, to say nothing of a human zygote. Flies, after all, have 100,000 cells in their brains alone. Of course, the point at which we fully acquire our humanity and our capacity to suffer remains an open question. But anyone who would dogmatically insist that these traits must arise coincident with the moment of conception has nothing to contribute, apart from his ignorance, to this debate. Those opposed to therapeutic stem cell research on religious grounds constitute the biological and ethical equivalent of a flat earth society. Our discourse on the subject should reflect this. In this area of public policy alone, the accommodations that we have made to faith will do nothing but enshrine a perfect immensity of human suffering for decades to come. But the tendrils of unreason creep further. President Bush recently decided to cut off funding to any overseas family planning group that provides information on abortion. According to the New York Times, this has effectively stopped condom provision to 16 countries and reduced it in 13 others, including some with the world's highest rates of AIDS infection. Under the influence of Christian notions of the sinfulness of sex outside of marriage, the U.S. government has required that one-third of its AIDS prevention funds allocated to Africa be squandered on teaching abstinence rather than condom use. It is no exaggeration to say that millions could die as a direct result of this single efflorescence of religious dogmatism. As Nicholas Kristof points out, sex kills, and so does this kind of blushing prudishness. And yet, even those who see the problem in all of its horror find it impossible to criticize faith itself. Take Kristof as an example. In the very act of exposing the medievalism that prevails in the U.S. government and its likely consequences abroad, he goes on to chastise anyone who would demand that the faithful be held fully accountable for their beliefs. "I tend to disagree with evangelicals on almost everything, and I see no problem with aggressively pointing out the dismal consequences of this increasing religious influence. For example, evangelicals' discomfort with condoms and sex education has led the administration to policies that are likely to lead to more people dying of AIDS at home and abroad, not to mention more pregnancies and abortions. But liberal critiques sometimes seem not just filled with outrage at evangelical-backed policies, which is fair, but also to have a sneering tone about conservative Christianity itself. Such mockery of religious faith is inexcusable. And liberals sometimes show more intellectual curiosity about the religion of Afghanistan than that of Alabama, and more interest in reading the Upanishads than in reading the Book of Revelation. This is Reason in Ruins. Christoph condemns the dismal consequences of faith while honoring their cause. It is true that the rules of civil discourse currently demand that reason wear a veil whenever she ventures out in public. But the rules of civil discourse must change. Faith drives a wedge between ethics and suffering. Where certain actions cause no suffering at all, religious dogmatists still maintain that they are evil and worthy of punishment. Sodomy, marijuana use, homosexuality, the killing of blastocysts, etc. And yet, where suffering and death are found in abundance, their causes are often deemed to be good, withholding funds for family planning in the Third World, prosecuting nonviolent drug offenders, preventing stem cell research, etc. This inversion of priorities not only victimizes innocent people and squanders scarce resources, it completely falsifies our ethics. It is time we found a more reasonable approach to answering questions of right and wrong.